It's not what you did, son, that angers me so. It's who you did it to.
Who? The fucking nobody?
That fucking nobody is John Wick.
Yay. It's episode number 48 of the Cut Print Film Podcast. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Howdy, folks. Welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 48. I am one of your hosts, Chris Evangelista.
I'm Jeff Rollins.
I'm Dave Costell, one of your hosts.
Yes, thanks.
I'm a guest. I'm not a host.
Did you say 48?
Yeah.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
That's a lot of podcasts.
I know. What's wrong with us?
Well, we have nothing better to do, apparently.
So we're a movie podcast, and we also have a website that's called cutprintfilm.com. You can find reviews and editorials there, and I have a little story about cutprintfilm.com. So I was trying to get a screener for a film called Looking for Mujahideen. It's a 4-hour documentary.
Why?
In two parts. Well, one of our writers, her name is Amy Anna. She writes almost exclusively about more artistic, arty films.
Mm-hmm. Art house, if you will.
They're in museums usually, those films.
Yes. Yeah. So she asked me if I get a screener for this film. So I sent an email to the production company, and the guy got back to me, and I'm paraphrasing here. Basically, his email was, "Are you sure your dumb site can handle my smart movie?" Because the same day I requested the screener, the front page of our site had an editorial about Demolition Man, written by Joe Tonzelli, who writes almost exclusively about trashy movies.
The top 10 murdered men, I still don't understand that title.
But I felt like this was a perfect sort of summation of our site. So I applied back to this gentleman and said, "Well, what makes Cut Print Film..."
Just with a picture of your teeth.
Yeah.
Smiling. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that makes literally no sense. So I said, basically, what I think makes Cut Print Film a unique site is that we don't limit ourselves. We don't talk about one type of film. We talk about as many types as possible. We're open to arty, long, dull documentaries, mm-hmm. and we're also open to just absolute trash. And this guy said, "Oh, okay, I get it now," and he sent me the link. But I thought that was just – it was amusing and also slightly offensive.
Yeah, I mean
– we have great scope.
We do. I don't understand that reaction. It seems a little – I don't know.
Here, I won't read the whole email, but this is basically what he said. He said, "Hi, Chris. Thanks for reaching out. How did you hear about the film?" So right away it's like – "Yeah, you're a commoner. How did you even find our beautiful film?"
In the back of Mad Magazine, it was like the wrong page was printed, and it told you about it.
So he goes on, "It's a 3-hour meditation, in parentheses, slow burn, of a documentary that leaves its audience with a profound spiritual feeling." So again, he's saying, this is a beautiful work of beauty, and your site is for babies.
All right, well... Just to pat ourselves on the back a little further before we get into today's show, if you go to cutprintfilm.com and you click on our editorial section, right above or right below an article about Chris Pratt,
right,
is an article about the Spanish filmmaker Carlos Saura,
right,
and his work with musicals and films about the body.
Right.
So.
And that was actually featured by the Criterion Collection this week.
Yeah, so not only have we been featured on Slash Film, a site that loves Lego movies, we've also been featured
and Legos.
We've also been featured on Criterion.com.
Right.
So this is a place, cutprintfilm.com is a place where you can find film writing across the spectrum.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like we're bragging, but the point we're all trying to make here is that it's just... there's something for everyone at cutprintfilm.com.
Yeah.
And we have great scope without having 64 writers. So, like, you'll be able to remember the person who wrote the article. Like, oh, they write nice stuff. They don't just write once a year.
Yeah, you can get an editorial voice from each of our writers and get to know them because we don't have, 115 of them.
Right.
We only have a small collective.
So, speaking of fine art, I saw a really, really great film this week, and by great I mean it was not great.
Oh, well, now that you've bait and switched us.
All right, so you can read my review of this film on cutprintfilm.com, and the film is Jupiter Ascending.
Is it the worst movie ever?
So, so there, it's
hanging with Mr. Jupiter.
I have a caveat with Jupiter Ascending because I gave it a negative review, and it's a bad movie, but I kind of love this movie.
Fish eggs?
What?
Yeah, caveat?
That's caviar.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Very similar in sound.
Totally derailed me there, so...
That's what I do best.
So yeah, Jupiter Ascending is a film from the Wachowski siblings. They made The Matrix, of course. That's probably one of their best films. Yeah. And then they've also made Speed Racer, which some people love that movie. It's got like sort of a cult.
My younger brother loves that.
It's got like a sort of cult following. I don't get it.
It looks great.
Yeah, I mean visually, but it's a crazy little film.
I like Emile Hirsch. He's in that.
Yeah, I like Emile Hirsch.
I mean,
as Speed.
He is. Anyway, so the Jupiter Ascending is a big boffo, crazy sci-fi extravaganza.
Yeah, it's like a space fantasy opera.
Right.
It sounds to me like they wanted to make Fifth Element without making it good.
It's similar in Fifth
Element. They made the Fourth Element. It's not quite as out there.
It's similar to Fifth Element in that it's a standalone film that's building its whole universe. That, and again, that's what Star Wars did so long ago too. But you know, it's more modern.
Yeah.
This is much sillier than that. So, in the film, Mila Kunis plays. Her name is Jupiter Jones, which
all right.
is pretty
I love it.
Pretty
not
fantastic.
To be confused with January Jones.
Yeah.
And she's a maid, but it turns out she's the reincarnation.
Is she a merry maid?
No.
What is a merry maid?
It's a company that comes and vacuums your home and goes through your mail.
she cleans toilets, basically. The first time we see her, she's cleaning toilets.
But wait, doesn't it... This sounds so familiar to Cloud Atlas with like where the clone girl is just like a servant.
I guess.
Does it have like a Cloud Atlas-y vibe?
No.
No?
Because
that's what I got from the trailer.
I mean, you know, it's the same directors, obviously, but honestly, I think Cloud Atlas is a better made film than this.
I actually enjoyed Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, I mean, Cloud Atlas is sort of an overwhelming movie because there's just so many subplots going on, but, you know, you can respect what they were doing with that. With this, it's just like, oh, what is this? This insanity.
But this is another movie where some lowly person is the one.
Right, pretty much. That's sort of what I guess they just like.
It's their bag.
Yeah. So
it's their bag. It's a beautiful bag. Mm.
Like when Speed Racer, he was the one.
Yeah, that's right.
Who could race?
He was the only one who could race. So Jupiter Jones finds out she's the reincarnation of this space queen, and I don't even want to talk about the plot. It's ridiculous. Basically, she's in it. Channing Tatum is in it as a guy who's half dog, half man.
Okay.
And he's got rocket skates. He skates around in the sky.
All right. So far, I'm in still.
He's really half dog?
Yeah.
What is that about? Like, does he bark and stuff?
He's got dog ears, and he sniffs things. He's got good smell.
Boy, does this sound stupid.
And
his eyes pop out like the wolf in a...
Oh, like the Tex Avery cartoon? No. Sean Bean is in it as a man named Stinger, and I guess he's called Stinger because he loves bees.
What?
Yeah, right? He's got a house full of bees.
I like music. You can call me Jeff Music.
Isn't that like a character in The Hobbit, the guy who has the bees, the bear bees guy?
I don't remember that, but let's just say yes. And but the standout of this film is a recent Oscar nominee, Eddie Redmayne, playing a character named Balaam Abrazax. So he's the villain. There's three villains in the film.
Gucci Mane?
Yeah.
Wait, what's his name?
Balaam Abrazax is
that,
the
that
name.
That rolls off the tongue.
There's a lot of goofy names in this film.
What does that translate to no Oscar for you? Is that what that means in English?
You know, the marketing for this film did a great job not showing Eddie Redmayne. I'm sure like his agent said, don't you fucking
get him out.
Yeah, cut him out of all the ads. Like, I tried to find on YouTube clips of him in the trailer, and there's probably like one, and it's very brief.
I remember seeing the trailer for this in theaters and last year, and he was heavily featured.
Right, and now...
So, and I haven't seen this film yet. You're the only one of the three of us that saw it, but I can just tell from the trailers, this is an insane performance.
So talk like this, like a computer
no,
in the movie.
That's
so,
a different film he's in.
Yeah. So the Eddie Redmayne's performance in this, it's almost worth the price of admission because it's so...
As Space Dracula?
Yeah, basically he's playing a fey 1700s vampire with a horse throat. He's acting like one of the foppish people in Barry Lyndon. But he's in space, and he's always wearing, like, robes.
Yeah, there's capes galore, right?
Yeah, and he does this voice. I'll try and do the best I can do with the voice, but basically it's this horse sort of British-y voice. He's just like, I want to get her and she must come to me.
I'm already tired.
And he does it the entire movie.
Already tired of that.
Entire movie, that voice.
Yes, Nick, like I can breathe.
No, even that's too high. It's like a whisper like this. It's like Ebenezer Scrooge.
I don't like it.
The whole movie.
I don't like that whatsoever.
But he acts like Lord Bullington.
It's just weird. It's such, I've never seen a performance this bizarre, and it like transfixes you. I was like, every time he was on screen, my attention just perked up. I was like, oh, he's going to do something weird again.
How often is he on screen?
He's in it more than you would think. I was thinking like, oh, he won't be in it a lot, but he does have he's the main villain. There's three villains. They're all siblings.
Right.
They're all trying to get Jupiter Jones. But he's the worst of the three.
This sounds very video game like.
It's weird.
But compared to Guardians of the Galaxy, a similar movie that came out this year, it fails on every front that succeeded on.
Yeah, basically, because Guardians of the Galaxy, that's a weird movie too, but this is weird in ways that you don't know what the hell's going on. And
the most disappointing thing that I read from your review is that Mila Kunis is like a powerless character. She does nothing to empower women.
That's
just strange.
Like, in this day and age, there's no excuse for a female lead. Because she's, in a sense, she's the lead. She's the main character. And she can't fucking do anything in this movie. Mm. Basically, she spends the whole movie, Channing Tatum has to rescue her every single scene. And I say this in my review, there's a scene where they're on, like, a space station or whatever. And she's in a room, and Channing Tatum is on the other side of the door. And she's like, how do you work this? She can't open a fucking door. Why would you? How can you write your female lead as not being able to open a door? That's just staggeringly
that's really
bad.
Is that meant to be comic relief?
Yeah, I guess. There's a lot of just weird jokes in this film, and they don't work. Like, she has a family. She comes from like a Russian immigrant family in the film.
Abrasaks, right?
No, those are the bad guys. Yeah. These are like the Earth family she has, and they're all.
The Kunis family?
Yeah, they're all like Russian immigrants, and they're all like wacky. They keep making jokes about Stalin because I guess that's what Russian people do at all times.
Naturally.
And like
in Russia, Jupiter is sent to you.
Like, her mom is frequently saying like Stalin's balls as like a thing. It's like,
what?
Stop it.
That's funny.
Yeah. That's not a saying.
It is for this film. And
that's not even funny.
Yeah, there's a flashback to Jupiter Jones's parents.
Oh, Joseph Stalin would send you to the gulag for that.
That's pretty much what it is.
That stinks.
And her dad's like an astronomer, and Russian thugs break into the house and they steal his gold telescope, and he gets killed over it. It's like, what?
At what point do they go to Jupiter?
They never do go to Jupiter.
That's the character's name, yeah. Jupiter Jones, remember?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I thought it was January.
Not to be confused with Jesus Jones, who did a popular single in the 80s.
What about the Jesus and Mary Chain?
Different band. Totally different band. Okay. Unrelated, in fact.
Well, this is going nowhere fast.
It's all right. So, yeah, Jupiter Ascending, I mean, I don't know. It bombed, obviously. It did not do well.
Oh, yeah. How much what did it do?
It made $5.
Boy, that's not even the price of a single ticket.
I think it made $19 million, and it cost $176 million.
Why do people keep giving them money?
Holding tight
movies
at a 22% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, that is abysmal.
So I feel like after this...
They're done?
I would say they're done. I just think they're going to have to start working with a smaller budget, which is good because I think that will ground them. They won't have to be... I don't know. It just feels like this movie, they're trying too
hard. Well,
they
need to be grounded. They've been bad.
Yeah, they have to go to the roof.
Yeah, like The Matrix was the only... like, because even V for Vendetta, I didn't like,
well, they didn't
like
that
movie. They didn't?
It,
I thought they did. Yeah. What else did they make?
Their very first film is a film called Bound, and that is an excellent movie.
Yeah, it is.
Aha, honey.
Yes, it's about that song. And it's like a small crime thriller. It mostly takes place in one apartment. And that's like a good movie. That's a really interesting... it's really well directed and stuff, like, you know, it's just a good film.
Yeah.
I've never even heard of that. That's strange. I thought the first thing they did was The Matrix.
No, The Bound was their first thing.
That's with Jennifer Tilly.
Right. Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon. And they're like lesbians who are stealing from the mob, and it's a good movie.
What's the other one they made that bombed horribly?
Jupiter Ascending and Speed Racer.
That's it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Cloud Atlas
and all of the Matrix films. Yeah, and Cloud Atlas. And Matrix 2 and 3.
This movie's been in production for a while, though, right? Jupiter Ascending?
Yeah, like, well, it was supposed to come out last year, and then it didn't, and now it is out, and they probably just should never have released it.
This was the secret screening at Sundance, and that's when everyone was it came out that this was terrible, but nobody could talk about it, so it was all done like very subtly.
Yeah, it was embargoed.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely horrible.
So yeah. Jupiter Ascending. Like I said, I don't like this movie, but I kinda love it just because of how bizarre it is. If it ever pops up on Netflix, I'd recommend just watching it on a rainy day.
That's what it seems like. Something I would just throw on just to see
what
Eddie Redmayne is doing.
I like Eddie Redmayne. I think he's a really good actor. I liked him in The Theory of Everything.
He's very good in that.
His performance in this, it's not bad. It's just weird. And he's totally committing to it. That's sort of what makes it remarkable.
Is it kind of like a Gary Oldman type deal?
It's sort of like that, but crazier. But he's all in.
Crazier than Gary Oldman.
Yeah, which says a lot.
Gary Oldman in True Romance crazy?
No one can be that crazy.
So do you think he's going to win the Oscar?
I don't know.
Gary Oldman, I'm talking about.
Oh, well, I don't think he's nominated, to be honest.
I mean, I'd give him it just because he deserves it.
For his performance at RoboCop. I think they're going to give it to him, the Oscar. Eddie Redmayne.
Probably.
For Stephen
it
Hawking.
Seems like, it's going that way at this point. It'll either be him or Michael Keaton. Also for RoboCop, ironically.
the smart money's on Steve Carell, though.
All right, so what do we do next? Did anything happen this week?
Well, next we're going to be reviewing naked photos of redheaded celebrities.
Wow.
It's a bit we're working on.
It's a piece for JoeBlow.com that we got cooking.
up first is Anthony Michael Hall. What do you guys think of this picture? How about this one?
I give it a 7.
That one. Look at that, a 4.5.
Nice. Okay.
On the dick scale.
Well, we're going to... We're going to be talking about Robert Altman again, wrapping up our Robert Altman director series.
Mm-hmm.
And this week we watched my pick for this series, and I hate to do this to everyone, but it was Fool for Love, 1985's Fool for Love. And before we get into it, do you want to go to break?
Yeah, we probably should. Just to break this up.
Yeah.
We'll go long on the back half, but... But for all you Altman heads out there, just skip right past the
break. Go to the doctors. There's something wrong with your head.
We'll be right back.
Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons, lemons, lemons.
Welcome back to FM Gold. I'm your host, Jet Li.
What a coincidence that name is.
Yeah. My parents have a sense of humor.
We were searching for Robert Altman.
We're not even going to get any lyrics on this one.
No, or we'll get sued.
We keep it going. Let's go. I got all night. Let's go.
We'll have this thing taken off YouTube in a second. Turn it off.
There it is.
Turn them off.
I want to watch the movie.
All right.
It's a little taste.
Now the fun's over. Yeah. Let's get into this.
Get back to misery.
We're wrapping up our Robert Altman director series.
Right. Director series is a thing where we pick a director, and then we pick three films and watch those three films, and then we talk about those three films.
And we typically do the films in chronological order, and that usually doesn't work out very well for us, and we might have to rethink this.
Yeah.
And then we typically play this before we start talking about them.
It's the Cutprint Film Director Series. Action.
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that song sums it up pretty. It's a really clear description of the director series.
So yeah,
now that everybody's caught up,
I'd like our listeners to weigh in. Maybe we should start curating the director series instead of picking three of them and just.
What do you mean?
Individually, like maybe as a group, we should come up with the three to make sure that they're all not shit.
Yeah.
Well,
that's what, yeah.
In this case,
we're not communists, Dave. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, the whole point of this experiment is to be exposed to the good and the bad. So yeah. It's just when we get the bad, it sucks.
It's less than desirable to talk about a bad movie.
Right. Well, it depends on the bad movie, but yeah.
But because this is an Altman movie and he's considered a genius, there's a little more to talk about this than something like Existenz, which we did a whole podcast on. But
yeah, somehow.
Right, it was just a lot of squishy noises for 3 hours.
What we have here is a movie called Fool for Love, which came out in 1985.
Wow.
And
the year I was born.
All right. I'll see a little history for everybody.
It was a bad year all around. Then this movie came out. Dave was born.
So what we have is this film was based on a play written by Sam Shepard, who also stars in the film. And Sam Shepard's a fantastic actor.
Yeah, I like him as an actor.
Yeah, he's in the right stuff, and he's great in that.
He's a good writer too. I've read some of his short stories. They're really, really good.
And this story is interesting,
right,
for Fool for Love. And Sam Shepard was in last year's August Osage County as the patriarch.
And you liked that movie,
right? I did. I liked him in it. I wish he was in it a little more, but he was really, really good in it. So it also stars Kim Basinger and Randy Quaid.
Remember him?
Who's usually fun. Remember when he went crazy?
Yeah.
That was fun. And also Harry Dean Stanton.
Right. I love Harry Dean Stanton. Mm-hmm. He's one of those great character actors. He's also one of those actors who's apparently always been an old man.
Yeah. he's actually credited as old man in this film.
Yeah.
That's his character's name. So,
old man, take a look at my life.
Now we're really going to get sued for character assassination on Neil Young.
Old is more like it.
Boy.
So what's this movie about?
Okay. Sam Shepard stars as Eddie, and Kim Basinger stars as May. They're the two central characters in Fool for Love. And we open on what is looks like a junkyard town, really. And May toils away in this motel where Eddie is her former lover, and he's long since been absent from her life. She went on the run and disappeared into this flea bag town. Unexpectedly re-entering May's life, Eddie picks up exactly where he left off by breaking down her door.
He breaks through the door.
He throws himself through the door like a cartoon character.
Uh-huh. And soon, almost immediately, the couple is bickering violently and making love with equal fervor.
Ooh.
There's peripheral characters that include Harry Dean Stanton, who plays a drunk bum.
Yeah.
And Martha Crawford is in it briefly as a aristocrat murderer.
Countess. They call her the Countess.
Yeah, the Countess. Randy Quaid's in it. He plays...
Cousin Eddie.
He plays May's current fling that's not too serious. He's also a dimwit.
He's also a crop duster, and he drives his plane into the alien ship at the end.
Remember me? He asks.
I'm back.
That is it.
Yes, the bulk of the cast.
This is clearly based on a play.
Right.
Well, do we spoil it or do we wait a little bit?
We're going to spoil it, but let's wait till we get to that.
Yeah.
All right. So it's very self-contained because it's based on a play.
Right.
The set is just this motel, this neon lit motel,
In the hills of some Midwest town.
Altman said that he couldn't find the right thing, so he just had his son build this set.
It looks like
desert.
A set. Yeah. It looks like a set.
But it's actually like it's not indoors.
No. It's obviously outdoors, but it looks like it was built for a movie.
It looks like it's like the back lot of Universal Studios
And this is one of those weird things where the set, like, you know how you were saying it with what movie was it, where the setting can be a character?
The Cave of Mrs. Miller.
Yeah. This is a movie that wants to do that, yeah. but the setting never comes to life.
I was engaged when the film first started with this town. I thought it was, oh, this is really neat looking.
The first, like, 10 minutes of the film, it feels like it's a horror movie.
Yeah, there's nobody saying anything. Yeah,
and, like, Sam Shepard, you don't see him. You just see his truck, and it's like Joyride. Right?
The whole film kind of feels like a horror movie.
Well, I have a theory, but I'll get to that all eventually.
Right. E equals MC squared?
Yes, yeah.
I think it's been done, but I'll have to check my books.
Yeah, but so it has like that potential when it first starts where you're like, man, this hotel's gonna connect somehow with me and come to life, and then it just doesn't.
Right.
Yeah, there's something about I like the isolation. There's nothing around
it's
for
so,
miles.
Like, quiet, yeah.
And there's only two people apparently living in this town. And there are no houses. It's just a store and a motel.
Because of that, it kind of felt like a Twilight Zone episode almost.
All right, well, so this is my theory about Fool for Love.
Okay.
That didn't take long.
Well, I just feel like, because you said Twilight Zone, I figure I might as well jump in. So my theory is that this is set in some sort of like afterlife, that this is not actually happening because it's too fantastical, the things that are happening. And the way the characters act, they don't act like living humans and the way they interact with each other, and there's so few of them.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's sort of like, I feel like this is like purgatory. Like, all these characters, they're dead and they're just trapped in this sort of netherworld, because Sam Shepard, he leaves at one point, but he's just magically back in the area, and it's not really explained how he's just suddenly back. And like, it's sort of like that thing where you can't really escape, basically.
It's strange because it is like a different dimension almost. It reminded me, this is strange, but like Coherence, like the dark zones. Like,
right. That's
like
a,
he can't get away from it. Like he just comes back into it.
And even at the end where it's like, I know we're jumping in too soon, but at the end there's like fire everywhere and characters are just like, you know, wandering off.
I like that theory. I didn't think of that. I have a theory about this film too. And my theory is that it's sort of, it exists in the two central character, May and Eddie's, minds.
Right, yeah.
This is definitely not a real place. I think that's perfectly clear.
I would agree with that. And even at some level, even if they are real, I would say maybe the Harry Dean Stanton character isn't really there.
Oh, I absolutely don't think he's there.
Because it just seems like there's a point where he's like talking to like Randy Quaid's character, and it seems like Randy Quaid is like not even like paying attention to him. And that,
Martin, Randy Quaid's character, is the only person that is, like, because there's characters in the background that are clearly like her father.
Yeah, that's their thing. It's like there's characters you see at the hotel area, but it's just them as kids.
May finds herself as a child and hugs herself, and that's not made clear that's what that was until the end.
It almost reminded me of that stupid movie Identity, with John Cusack, and they're like all the characters at a hotel, but they're all like in some guy's head. It was almost like that. Yeah.
It is a little like that.
Yeah. It's better than that because it doesn't drill it into your head.
Oh yeah.
Do you get it?
And then once you learn the twist, the film somehow goes on for another 40 minutes.
So, I think that, the father character played by Harry Dean Stanton, because let's just get it out in the open now. We find out that these two lovers are brother and sister to the same man.
Yeah.
Who's Harry Dean Stanton?
Different mothers, and the man is Harry Dean Stanton. He had a double lives. And
Sam Shepard is her brother from another mother.
Yeah, that is that's the Latin term.
Yes, that's the medical term, I believe.
Harry Dean Stanton's their father, and Eddie's mother was his first wife, who he was cheating on May's mother with, and Eddie's mother eventually committed suicide via shotgun.
He was living like two lives, basically. Yeah. He would stay with one family for a while, then he would just disappear and go off to the other family.
So there's this constant battle with his father and her father, and I think that is why that character is so kind of omnipotent. He's ever present. He's there from frame one of the film. And they're always they interact with him sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly.
Right.
But the Randy Quaid character, who plays this boyfriend type to May, that appears at the very end of the movie, to which they spill the beans about their brother-sister relationship. I think that's supposed to be like when you talk to yourself,
that audience that isn't really there. I think that's what the Randy Quaid character is supposed to represent.
Like the person you're trying to convince, when you're making a mental argument.
Yeah, you're coming to a mental realization of something, and you're like presenting your case to somebody that's indifferent, and that would be the Randy Quaid character. And that's going with my theory of this exists in the confines of the character's mind.
Right.
That makes sense too, because the father, he's always just... he'll just appear in the background, kind of like sitting in a chair,
drinking, always drinking.
And it's like he's always like he's the conflict of the relationship.
Yeah,
no matter, they can't go too long without thinking, oh, we have the same father. And then he appears. And it's almost
terrible,
like
a reminder.
Yeah.
Right.
And he's also like pitting them against each other, because at the end, there's like a big dramatic. This is like my favorite scene in the movie, actually, where there's like a big realization where they realize they can just get along, sort of, and he's saying to Sam Shepard's character, he's like, you have to stand up for me, and you know, because he's a dick.
So the film opens with this town and where May is living, and she has it's revealed that she has escaped Eddie in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
We don't know how long she has been escaped from this relationship, and at that time, we assume that they're a married couple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because he comes out of nowhere, and the very first thing he does is, as I said, tackles through her door as she's hiding in the bathroom. And so, yeah, you think that this is a married couple, and you get the feeling that maybe she just ran away for a few weeks or so. But the more and more the film goes on, you get the feeling that this has maybe been a couple years that she's been in hiding from him, trying to get away, because these characters, it's clear that they are inseparable. They will always come back to one another, kind of like magnets.
Yeah.
I'd like to rewatch it with Chris's theory.
Never like to rewatch this film.
Because, are there clues in there that she killed herself? And
I just like the way they all behave, especially her character, they just behave like they're shell shocked. And they just I don't know, I really get the sense that, and just the sense that he just shows up out of nowhere. It just feels like they're just dead, and they're just suddenly all
arriving. I do like that theory. I think that's a really good theory, especially with the fire at the end.
Yeah, because at the very end of the film, Harry Dean Stanton's character, his trailer's on fire, and he just goes inside it calmly, and it's sort of just like, it's like, oh, he's going to hell. Like, they're all going off to where they belong. Like, they're in this way station purgatory sort of thing. And at the end of the film, they go where they belong.
And I really, really like this story a lot. I like Sam Shepard's writing. Right. I like his performance. I like...
It's a great...
It's got big ideas.
It's tragic. It's,
it's a story that should be a play, not
That's
a
where
movie.
I'm going with this. Right, I would love to see this on the stage, but this is not as strong material for a film like something like Glengarry Glen Ross,
right,
where you can take that that rapid-fire dialogue with these powerhouse actors... and make it into a compelling, confined into two settings, feature-length movie. This was a chore to get through, I'll be honest. It's nearly 2 hours.
Oh, yeah.
It is rough.
And even though it's a compelling story, I found myself looking at the clock.
Yeah. Because the performances are very physical, and it's a lot of
there's a long pauses between characters saying things. And I don't need a ton of dialogue, but you got to give me something better than a Kim Basinger performance, and I think we got to talk about that.
I would say I think this could work as a movie. I think the biggest problem with this film is Robert Altman. I feel like he's not the right person for this material. For one thing, if it is an afterlife, or if it is things existing in people's heads, that's very fantastical.
You're right.
Robert Altman is not he's not a surrealist director. He's a modernist. Mm-hmm. And he's more grounded in real things.
And responding to real life events.
And he's also very low energy, as we've learned. Robert Altman has a very lackadaisical approach to things. And this play is all about just people enraged with passion. And Altman doesn't do that. He cares more about people just being in areas.
Yeah, they're enraged with passion, and yet they can barely find the energy to express that rage.
And
it's crazy.
And I think that's Altman's fault more than the performances, because a good director, and I'm not saying Altman's a bad director, but it's part of the director's job to get those performances out of his actors.
Yeah.
And clearly Altman wasn't interested in doing that with this film.
And apparently the first cinematographer who was on the project, Robbie Mueller, he wanted to do different things, like you're suggesting, more fantastical,
like
thing.
Surreal sort of stuff.
Yeah, and step away from what Altman was used to doing. Mm-hmm. But
I will say
Altman fired him and brought on a guy who would do the more Altman-esque things.
I will say, though, of the three films we watched, this was the one that felt the least like an Altman film.
Oh, absolutely.
There's none of that mumbling where characters walk around mumbling to themselves. I was shocked that wasn't in this film.
They just don't say anything at all.
Yeah.
But there's still those, you know, those pan zooms.
No, there's still that touches. It's just when we watch McKee and Mrs. Miller and then Long Goodbye, which both clearly feel like that Altman sort of thing. This doesn't fit with that. So, yeah, do you want to talk about the actors, the performances?
Yeah. Let's start with Kim Basinger, who I think is the least of the performers in this film.
She's just not good in this role.
She didn't bother me as much, but I don't think she's a strong enough
person
for the character.
In the beginning of the film where Eddie first comes in after he busts through the door and they're arguing, where she kind of like throws her head between her legs off the side of the bed.
Yeah.
And it's so animated and cartoonish.
And then she clings to his leg.
Yeah. It's this over dramatic high school play type performance that sucked me right out of the film. And I was so angry. Like,
it's something that
I was engaged up until that point.
Even later when she hugs the little kid and then falls down in the sand, it's like it wasn't hitting it.
It reminded me of the scene in Teen Wolf where where they're rehearsing for the high school play and he's in full wolf mode, but he's dressed as a Civil War soldier. And they're doing these over the top Southern accents, but yeah, that's what that reminded me. Just bad high school stage theater.
Yeah, it's very stagey acting. It's acting that would look better in a play than it did in a film, basically.
Yep. And I don't know. Sometimes I don't mind her performance, but a lot of times it's her physical presence that it just isn't there for me. It doesn't do anything for me.
I mean, I think she sells. Like, I mean, the character is supposed to be, you know, fucked up, for lack of a better term. And I think she sells that well. That damaged good sort of thing.
It's also frustrating the way she just goes back and forth on how she feels about Eddie.
But that's like, I think that's
the point.
Keeping with like abused women do that sort of thing.
I was going to say, going back to why the film's hard to get through is because you keep going through these, I'll call them scenes for lack of a better word, but they're so inconsequential. Like nothing as a result of it. So you kind of get fatigued because you're like, by the fifth one, you're like, oh, they're going to argue.
It becomes annoying.
It's constantly up and down. Like, all right.
One of them's going to storm out.
Right.
And then it's going to settle back down. And then he's going to come back in and do it again.
Yeah. And for anybody who's actually lived through a relationship like this, it's absolutely enraging. And yes. I thought about calling both of you and saying, let's do something else. Let's do another movie because I don't want to watch this.
We were both waiting for that call.
But I thought, I don't like them that much.
In fact, at one point, I literally said, Jeff, it's not too late to pick another movie. And he said, no, we're doing this.
I set a text, auto text. I would text him the word Nashville over and over again. but so what do you think of Sam Shepard? Because he's giving an equally as strange, like, physical performance.
He's good for strange physical performances. And I love him in this.
Yeah. He's clearly a better actor. Yeah. And
it's a much more physical performance, mostly because I'm used to Sam Shepard as an older actor. Mm-hmm. So I'm not used to him
as a young man.
Yeah. Being so physical. So he's really like, you know, he's busting through doors and stuff in this movie and throwing lassos around.
Boy, is he ever. He lassos a jukebox.
That was the other thing that convinced me that this is like a surreal afterlife sort of thing, because not only does he lasso a jukebox, but the minute he does it, it starts playing music, which would not happen in real life.
He's like when Mork from Ork gave Fonzie powers. And Fonzie could just pound on the side of a jukebox and would play whatever song he wanted.
Right, pretty much.
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
Sam Shepard lassoing the jukebox harkens back to Robert Altman's.
Did you look this up somewhere? No.
He's good in this role, and that's what throws the film off, because it like seesaws it, where you got one guy getting a great performance, so it kind of makes his performance not good in a way.
Her awful performance drags his great performance down, because
just like you said, the polarity is so off.
Yeah.
And also it goes back to how her character is so up and down
right.
moment to moment. It's just too much.
So when you get a scene where he's acting with, like, so the scene where he's acting with Randy Quaid and he's laying on the floor, like, he keeps kicking his boot into the wall.
That fucking scene drove me insane. Yep.
I was just gritting my teeth.
Like, but, that's what it's meant to do, and yeah. I kind of like that scene. It's annoying.
I didn't dislike this movie as much as I know Jeff did, but that scene... I watched this movie last night at, 2 in the morning, and that's that scene where basically Randy Quaid and Sam Shepard are having a conversation, and for some reason, Sam Shepard keeps taking apart a bed, and I'm just like, can this fucking scene end, please?
I didn't think they had IKEAs around back then, but this fucking bed is in pieces, and Randy Quaid puts it together,
it right back together,
and then it falls apart again.
It's just, it goes on and on. I was like, all
it's
right.
Endless.
That's where the movie started to wear
it's
me
It's a
out.
Microcosm of the whole film.
But
it is just endless.
To the fragility
Get
of
out.
Their sexual relationship. Okay, so the other thing is that them being bad in a, you know, for lack of a better word, makes Randy Quaid and Harry Dean Stanton seem like insanely good in this movie.
Well, I feel like Harry Dean Stanton is always good in anything, even if he's like in one scene in a film.
I like Randy Quaid, and I think he's
great in this.
He is excellent in this. He's also great in Kingpin, but... Where he plays the same character.
Yes.
He released a video this week that he's great in. Mm. Did you guys see that?
Yeah,
where he wants to be thanked for saving the world because apparently he's gone so insane that he thinks Independence Day was a real thing.
That's all I can think about while watching this.
Me too. But I did enjoy his performance. I liked the character of that, benevolent.
Like goofy, innocent kind of guy. Yeah.
Just a dumbbell.
I liked when Dennis Quaid showed up.
No. Nope.
And then they started fighting.
That's his older, less hornier brother.
But Harry Dean Stanton does a great job of, he's so weird.
I loved how despicable he is in this film because,
But, even at first, he's a weird, rat almost.
He starts in the film, he's sort of, a bumbling character, and, I liked him. I was like, oh, he's, a goofy old man. And by the end of the film, I fucking hated how awful this character was.
When
and that's intentional.
He's picking through Sam Shepard's truck when he first pulls up.
Yeah, he's drinking his booze.
Just drinking all his tequila. And then the first thing he says, and this is strange looking back at it, because Eddie is his son. The first thing he says to him, he's like, got any tequila?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you already drank my tequila.
Yeah, and that just confused me a little bit as to whether that character was really there or what that character represented.
Right.
And that was before I got to the end of the film where all of it's...
Yeah, because you don't find out right away.
It's almost like a ghost. Like, he's just haunting the hotel.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, so what is the hotel?
Well, it's the... You can go with either theory we've presented here. I'm sure there's plenty more online.
Because there's nothing online.
Yeah,
about
it's weird. Like, that's the other thing.
I know. There's not a whole lot of information on this film.
When I had this theory last night to myself, I was like, that seems fairly obvious. Let me Google it. Fucking no one came up with that theory. And I'm like, I'm not that smart. Yeah. So I just feel like no one just talks about this film.
Well, yeah, nobody saw it either. It was a bomb. Yeah. This was theatrical bomb.
The movie's also trying to say something about femininity because everything's so pink. There's the pink neon lights. She's in a pink dress. Yeah. There's
all the female characters are just get walked all over in this film. They don't, they barely
except
exist.
Except for the Countess, who is firing a gun.
Who doesn't have, I don't think she has a single line though. So.
Not one.
Everything's bathed in neon pink light in this film. But like I said, it's trying to say something about femininity, but I don't know what it's trying to say, because nothing's ever resolved in this movie.
Yeah, the thing's so abstract that you can't make sense. There's not a clear narrative of this film at all.
What I take away from this film is people are awful, but I already knew that, so I don't know if I needed a movie to remind me. So
the one thing I really liked is it kind of reminded me of No Country for Old Men at times, because it has that same banality of the Western that it seems to be addressing, how this is all so overdone and the masculinity. So I like that aspect of it. And just,
I don't know. I wouldn't read too much into that. I don't think he was going for
deconstructing
anything here, honestly.
I mean, maybe the play is. It just, I don't know.
This I'm looking at it now. This film opened its opening weekend. It opened in two theaters.
Well, then.
And its widest release was 57 theaters. It was in and out.
Ooh, maybe we should have looked at that.
it's
almost doesn't qualify as a movie.
It opened in December and it closed in February. So it did not do well at all. Nobody writes about this film.
Except for us. Yeah. Starting this week. It's full for love week.
So stay away from cutprintfilm.com all week. Check back next Sunday.
I don't know. I mean, like I said, I didn't hate this movie.
No, but, I don't hate it, but
it's just, I don't know.
When you compare this to McCabe and Mrs. Miller, right, and especially The Long Goodbye, it's just apples and turds.
Yeah. Like I almost wish someone different would remake this. Someone who has a better surrealist style. Yeah. I feel like you could actually make a good movie.
You could. And like I said, I would love to see this on stage.
Yeah. Oh,
it's
absolutely.
A fascinating story. I would love to see somebody else do these line readings.
Right.
Other than Kim Basinger.
Even to just like read the play would probably be better than just watching.
Yeah, I love the story. I think it's a fascinating story. You can get a lot out of the actual screenplay. But man, oh man,
I mean,
the execution is not there.
There's a few scenes I did like the way they were done. There's a scene where Harry Dean Stanton, he's talking to Kim Basinger and he's telling her a story about her childhood. And the way he's telling a story is clearly not how it's happening. I really liked the way that.
Yeah, they do
done.
That twice. They mirror that because when Sam Shepard tells the story about how he went walking with his dad.
Right, yeah.
He's saying things that are happening that are not happening on screen.
And
it's
like
clearly a child viewpoint of, you know, the right. father being this Superman that can do all these things, but he's really, you're seeing exactly how it happened.
I like that because that's a great way to use, you know, the narrative of film. Cause you can't really do that on stage unless you have someone on stage talking. And then like that, I feel like those scenes they work the best because it's like the only time Altman's like, oh, this is a movie. let me actually use movie tricks here. Like I liked that.
Yeah, but all the interior shots feel like you're watching a bad play.
Yeah, because there's no, you know, they're not a little, you know.
And that's why, I think that's why that scene where he's taking apart the bed annoys you, because it feels like, oh, this is a movie, so he should be doing something instead of just standing there talking.
Yep. Yeah.
So they throw in weird action.
Yeah, they'll roll around the way, just the way that
gets spur into the wall.
God, just the way that film drove me nuts. Because like half of that shot is Sam Shepard's on the floor. You don't even see him. You see like his leg. And I'm just like, fucking end this scene right now.
And again, to mirror Kim Basinger throwing her head between her legs on the edge of the bed, Sam Shepard falls, collapses drunk in the corner later on in the film, and does the exact same pose. And it's just as obnoxious.
Would you have preferred the lines read by Kim Billy the Bass Singer?
Take me to the river.
How long have you been waiting to say that?
Holy crap.
Have you been Chris waiting? Cut me off earlier.
Okay. All right.
I'm glad I did, because I saved it for this moment.
This kind of reminded me of Death Proof at times. Did you get that vibe?
No, not at all.
It has that like quiet single set vibe.
I guess.
I can see that.
The one thing it did actually remind me of is Barton Fink. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but that's also taking place in a hotel, and that's sort of representing a purgatory place. And at the whole end of Barton Fink, the hotel goes up in flames.
Yeah.
And John Goodman's character, he just casually goes into his room while it's on fire, and that's what Harry Dean Stanton does at the end of this film.
Yeah. That's a cool parallel.
Again, apples and turds. Right.
Barton Fink's a better film. I'd rather watch that than this.
This reminds me of the Grand Budapest Hotel, because
let's name all hotel movies.
So, okay, we're done.
For Dogs. You guys remember that movie with the dogs?
The second best Marigold Hotel.
Dunstan Checks In.
We're done with Fool for Love.
Are we?
You can.
I hope so.
So we were pretty much Robert Altman virgins before coming into this.
Yeah.
Right.
So how do you feel about him now?
Well, I definitely appreciate him more than when we started.
Yeah. Same here. Like I said, when we first started the Altman director series, my only experience with Robert Altman was Popeye, and that movie is pitiful.
I was listening to Quentin Tarantino, and I agree with him on this. He was saying that Altman is like the Rolling Stones, where you're not a fan of
Quentin
them.
Quentin Tarantino and the Rolling Stones analogies.
He's like, he's like, I don't like the Rolling Stones, but I like some of their songs, so, and I appreciate what they did for music. And that's kind of how, that's a good way to look at Robert Altman.
I like Robert Altman more than I like the Rolling Stones.
Well, I love the Rolling Stones, so where do I fit in this conversation and analogy?
You have to go wait in the garage.
With the car running.
Yes, please. At my request.
Some of the things he does can just get, they're like tiresome.
Oh, that mumbling thing, I loathe that. Yeah. I wish he didn't do that because I can't stand it.
But this was a different time. He was trying things out. They didn't have digital technology, so you couldn't test things on the fly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm sure he didn't find out that the mumbling, overlapping dialogue didn't work until they were in post-production.
Right.
Everything had been filmed and recorded.
Oh, well, this is shit.
Well, better put it out anyway.
What else am I going to do?
But yeah, I'm coming out of this as a big fan of Robert Altman, and I actually look forward to watching a lot more of his films.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna finish off the filmography and just watch them all.
Oh, get it, I'm not gonna get that nuts. I got things to do. But
yeah, clothes to wash, yeah,
and shirts to iron. Pants to wrinkle.
I was talking about my 25-year plan.
Oh, all right.
So before I'm 50-something.
That's very ambitious of you.
Yeah, I mean, after The Long Goodbye, I would say I'm an Altman fan now, just because that movie was much better than I expected it to be. And I had seen a few Robert Altman films before he started. I've seen The Player, which is a pretty good movie. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's like one of his most popular mainstream films. I feel like that's the one everyone knows. But
And as we mentioned, Shortcuts, that's the one.
Right.
With, Magnolia by Paul Thomas Anderson.
Right, it's pretty much the same movie.
Takes a lot of cues from.
Nashville is the one you hear the most about.
And Mashville.
Yeah. And
go on, you were saying.
A good Robert Altman joke.
You got it.
That I'm sure three people got who are listening.
Yeah, I have not seen Nashville or Mashville, but hopefully I will see them both eventually.
All right. So that concludes this. Our next director is who?
It's my pick, and we're going with Kathryn Bigelow.
Yeah, our first woman on the director series.
The woman gigolo.
She's not a gigolo, and women aren't typically gigolos.
Yes,
they're generally prostitutes.
Doesn't make any sense.
They're going to work in the sex industry. Or madams.
Most famous for being James Cameron's wife.
Wow.
Nope, absolutely incorrect.
That's it.
That was a joke.
She is most famous for probably directing Zero Dark Thirty.
Yes.
Well, she won the Oscar for Hurt Locker.
Right. Yeah.
Correct? Yes.
Yes. Although I
Zero Dark Thirty is the better film.
Yeah, I prefer that. Yeah.
But yeah, she's done a lot of great films, and I'm really looking forward to doing this director series. And
yeah.
I wanted to do a woman because I was well aware that we've only done white men.
Right.
Which...
In our defense, it's not really our fault because that's who makes films, apparently.
Yeah, they're the only people they give cameras to for some
right.
reason up until the last 10 years. It's ridiculous.
Well, that's what's tough is we're trying to get like a 20-year gap of work.
Right. And I mean, there's really good female filmmakers like Claire Denis, but that's all foreign films, and I don't know that I want to just yet do a director series of all foreign films.
Yeah.
I obviously we will in the future.
It's not there yet.
I just didn't want to do that for our first female director to be that so specific of a filmmaker.
So we want to give away what we're watching or let it be a surprise?
Well, let's just say the first up is Point Break, which is one of my favorite action films. God, I love this
film. Is that your pick?
That's my pick. Point Break, where featuring the ex-presidents.
Yes. George W. Bush. Jimmy Carter.
I forget who else is in it. Dracula.
Get your surfboard ready.
Leslie Nielsen's in it.
Yeah. It's a fun film.
So Michael J. Fox as the Teen Wolf.
So yeah, Kathryn Bigelow.
Yeah, that's our next director that we're doing. And, it should be fun.
And I mentioned this last week, but if you out there in podcast land have a director you want us to take on in
Send
the ring.
Tim Burton.
No.
Oh.
No, we're
Bim
not.
Bim Turton.
All right.
Nope. All right. Send us an email, please.
No.
Yeah,
Bim Turton.
You can send us an email to info@cutprintfilm.com, right. And we will take your requests.
Or tweet at us, at Cutprint Film.
Yeah.
We will file it in the request bin. Man.
Yes, and then we will set it on fire.
Yes.
Set it ablaze, if you will. So, yeah, let's recommend some movies, because I've had enough of this. It sure would.
Thanks, everyone.
My goodness.
Was that the wall of sound?
Yeah, it was the wall.
It's the Phil Spector wall of sound.
I had like 20 tracks going on that.
It shows. That was excellent. Who wants to go first? Because I won't do it.
Dave, you go.
Okay, let me find a movie to recommend. You okay?
Jesus Christ.
What a good show this has been.
No, I'm just kidding. I had one up here. Oh. And I'm having trouble remembering. Oh, yeah, okay. So I've recommended a film from this director before, but I'm going to recommend another one because I just love him.
Same film.
I'm going to recommend Steve McQueen's Shame, a 2011 movie about sex.
No, oh, I'm sorry.
What happened?
Something must have slipped.
Because 50 Shades of Grey is coming out this week. Yes. I wanted to
it sure is.
To maybe touch on a film that actually deals with the problems of sexual addiction, which I don't even know. Is that movie about sexual
Not
addiction?
Not at all, okay. No.
Whatever.
Go on.
It's about spanking.
Steve McQueen's Shame, 2011. Did I say all that yet?
Yeah, you did.
Okay. Yep. I'm just recapping in case anyone lost. It's about this dude who lives in New York City, played by Michael Fassbender. And it's a very small movie because it just focuses on this one guy,
right.
But it's kind of like a Dante's Inferno of sexual addiction where he's already well into it when the movie starts, but it just goes through his psychosis of him. There's one scene where he throws all the porn and stuff away in his house, and he throws his laptop away,
right.
And but like within a couple days is right back to that level of extreme.
It's a very unsexy movie about sex. Like, there's nothing enjoyable about the sex in this film.
Is it as good as that film Choke, the Chuck Palahniuk adaptation?
Ugh.
Don't even bring that up.
Boy, was that bad.
So not only is this movie like a good story and a great performance, but it's fucking awesome to look at. There's a scene of Steve McQueen jogging through New York City that is
Michael Fassbender, you mean, not Steve.
I don't believe Steve McQueen jogs.
Have you seen him?
He rides his motorcycle through New York City.
Yeah, he jumps it.
Michael Fassbender jogging through New York City is one of my favorite like scenes, like cuts that I've ever seen. Yeah. So just watch it just for that scene.
Okay.
And then turn it off.
Yeah. Turn it off once that scene wraps it up.
I'm gonna fuck you.
Wow.
That was Randy Quaid from his latest video.
Oh, the one I mentioned earlier?
Yes, that'd be the one. I guess I'll go.
He's crazy.
He sure is. I'm gonna recommend playing on the theme of Sam Shepard and also a conversation the three of us had this morning about the work of Terrence Malick and how I am not a big Malick head.
Hmm.
Malachite, they're called.
Yeah, Malachi from Joan
of the Corn. Outlander!
Yeah, he's a regular He Who Walks Behind the Rose. I'm going to recommend a Terrence Malick film starring Sam Shepard. It's 1978's Days of Heaven.
Yes.
Have you seen this?
I was going to pick this. This was my pick.
Wow, that's insane.
Yes.
Okay. You did it. Ding, ding, ding.
Because I was also doing the same thing, the Sam Shepard angle.
That's kind of crazy.
But it's anyway, a double pick. Go on, Jeff.
Well, in 1910, a Chicago...
How much are you going to wager on the Daily Double?
No, we're not doing any game show type stuff. In 1910, a Chicago steelworker accidentally kills his supervisor and flees to the Texas Panhandle with his girlfriend and little sister to work harvesting wheat in the fields of a stoic farmer who's played by Sam Shepard.
Okay, Chris, now you say the same thing.
Okay, no.
Let's see who did it better.
I'll do it backwards.
Who wore it better? Pharrell's hat.
It's a gorgeous movie.
It's Teddy Roosevelt wore it better.
It's like, it's unlike any film I've ever seen before.
Malick, he shot this entire film always at magic hour. A magic hour is when the sun is setting or rising. Yeah. So every scene in this film
it's midnight when the witches come out.
That's the witching hour.
Because of that, because he filmed the whole thing in magic hour, everything's dreamlike.
Yeah.
And that's a Malick-ism, if you will. That he does a lot in his films, and right. It's usually irritating to me. But in this film, it's fucking beautiful. There's a lot of gorgeous Midwest U.S. Shots, even though it was filmed in Canada.
Yes.
But it's amazing looking. And Richard Gere's in it, and he's actually good.
Yeah, he is.
Sam Shepard is in it. He's fantastic. It's another young Sam Shepard role.
Right.
And he plays this dying millionaire landowner who, surprise, he doesn't die.
Right.
How Malicky is it, though? Is it?
It's Malicky. Okay.
It's Malicky, but it's a little more restrained than later Malick.
Not a lot. The script must have been 4 pages long.
I mean, there is, you know, the voiceover and stuff, but it's not every single scene. You know?
Yeah. And there's not a whole lot of dialogue between characters.
There's not a whole lot of shaking going on either.
No, not... Not much at all.
So those scenes you were talking about earlier, Chris, the ones you liked, they had like a kind of Malick vibe to them.
What, in Fool for Love?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But
sort of.
Malick does it better.
Just specifically the one with the cows.
Yes, that was very Malicky. Just with the voiceover and stuff. Yeah. I will agree.
That actually reminded me of Days of Heaven, and that's why I chose it.
It reminded me of Days of Thunder. I don't know why.
That's a different film.
Put him into the wall, Cole!
Is that Cold Trickle?
Yeah, Cold Trickle.
Very good. So, yeah, that is my pick, 1978's Days of Heaven.
I'm going to fuck you.
Chris?
My pick is Days of Heaven. No, we've already been over this. Since Jeff picked my pick, I will pick 1997's The Sweet Hereafter, which is a film by, I don't know how to say his name, Adam Egoyanian.
Oh, all right.
He's a Canadian director. This is based on a book.
He directed that film, The Captive,
which is not good, I hear.
No, it's not good at all.
This film is very good. This film takes place in a small town in British Columbia. And a school bus in a snowstorm goes off a bridge and several kids in the bus are killed. And it's basically about a lawyer played by Ian Holm coming to town to try and – basically someone wants to sue someone. No one knows who they want to sue, but
– that sounds good.
It's basically like someone wants someone to pay for these kids' deaths. And it's a depressing movie, but it's fucking – it's gorgeous. It looks beautiful. The music in the film is fantastic. Sarah Polley is in it. She was younger at the time, and she's very good. She survives the crash, but she's in a wheelchair. And I mean, there's not a lot of story to it. It's basically just a character film. It's about this whole town, how they're reacting in, you know, the aftermath of this tragic accident. And Ian Holmes' character, he's just conflicted because he has a daughter who's a drug addict, and she keeps calling him for money. And it's a really unique film. I saw this when I was in high school, and it was one of the first times I'd ever seen a film like this. And I was like, I'm not used to movies like this. And it sort of blew me away. And it's just stuck with me ever since. It's just a really beautiful film. I would recommend it. It's very snowy. So it's a cold sort of film.
Nice.
And, I'd recommend tracking this down if you haven't seen it. It's called The Sweet Hereafter.
Is it available streaming anywhere?
I'm not sure. No? I know it was. It might not still be on there. If not, I'm sure you could find it at Blockbuster Video. Are they still around?
Nope.
In the clamshell case?
Nope. You have to go to the Red Box outside of your local Babbage's.
Well,
that'll do it, folks, because I've had enough.
We're huffing and puffing here at the finish line.
Yeah, we're really sputtering out this episode. We'll be back next week with nothing better.
We'll have Point Break to talk about.
Yeah, Point Break and maybe 50 Shades of Grey if we end up seeing it.
Yeah.
But, all 50 of them.
Yeah, well, maybe just get to 46 because those last four are a little too hardcore for me.
They totally go off the rails. Yeah.
They're nearly black. We will have a review for 50 Shades of Grey on cutprintfilm.com.
Right.
Whether or not the three of us see it, we'll have a review.
Yeah. We'll make up the review, three of us.
No, no, no. We'll send one of our writers to see the film because I won't be watching it probably.
Anything else, Jeff? You're seeing The Kingsman this week?
Yes, I'll be seeing and reviewing Kingsman Secret Service, starring... Who was that starring?
Colin Firth.
Colin Firth. And hopefully Colin Farrell makes an appearance.
Yeah, hopefully all the Collins are in. Colin Malloy from the December issue.
Boy, that
up.
Would be great. Colin Quinn, the comedian. That was pretty good.
On the fly, Costell, at it again.
Colin Costell. See, it's easy. Yeah, like we said earlier, you can check us out on Twitter at @CutPrintFilm. You can check us out on Facebook, where we post links to all our articles and reviews.
And you won't see them because Facebook sucks and they do something weird with that.
Facebook has to do something about that algorithm. Yeah. It's not doing us any good. And you can go to cutprintfilm.com and see all our reviews, editorials, interviews, essays, and the like.
Go to joystickjerks.com for a funny podcast.
Yes, they do a podcast.
Video games.
Yes. You sold that well.
A video game podcast. There's fart sound effects and everything you could possibly want. You can also go to antifanboy.com. I don't believe they have fart sound effects.
Well, they should get on that.
But you can probably email them and say, hey, more fart sound effects. Yeah. Please.
Don't email us that. Email us director series requests.
Yeah. Like we said earlier, if you have a director you want us to talk about and visit three films from that director, send us that guy's name.
Also, don't be an asshole about it and be like, the guy who directed all the Police Academy films, because we're not going to do that.
No, I'll have your IP banned.
Stay tuned after this for the Talking Cut Print Film podcast, where Chris Hardwick breaks down everything we did tonight.
Boy, does that sound tedious.
Yeah. And go to iTunes, give us a rating.
A 5-star rating. Don't give us a 1-star rating, or I'll have your fucking head.
Whoa.